Hi, my name is Cindy. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's good to be here tonight. I'm not always sure where I am, but I've gotten used to that over the years. I'm in a room tonight where it feels right, and you all sound right. You sound well. The young man celebrating 1 year said that his first year was like being on a roller coaster. I have 15 years, and what I'd like to say is, just wait. The roller coaster gets better. There are a lot of new people here tonight. And as far as I can tell at this point, sobriety is not for the faint-hearted. It is the greatest challenge I've ever had. Not to stay sober, but to stay sane sober. I'll talk a little more about that. 20 years ago, a fellow graduate student asked me why I drank. And I said, it's very simple, because I'm awake. That, by the way, is the same reason I smoke today, simply because I'm awake. And I heard recently a new definition of sober. Maybe you've heard it. The latest definition is, son of a bitch, everything's real. And that, in my opinion, is why sobriety is not for the faint-hearted. Living life on life's terms, meeting things as they come, being okay with who I am, is a daily challenge and a daily opportunity. Al and I were talking a minute ago about the reality that drinking for me was both a blessing and a curse. Sobriety for me has been both a blessing and a curse. Many of the things I referred to 10 years ago as character defects have saved my life later in sobriety. Those of you who've been around for a while probably understand that. Coming to terms with who I am this minute is what this path is about. Because who I am this minute changes from day to day. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was not very much left. But there was enough left for you all to breathe life back into me. In the winter of 1972, I walked into a restaurant where I seldom went in Kansas City, Missouri, where I lived and drank. My drugs of choice were scotch and morphine. My preference, needless to say, is morphine. Anyone who knows about the difference between scotch and morphine knows there's really not even a contest. But there are times when morphine is difficult to obtain. I had developed the skill of working for veterinarians. I was a dog nurse for a long time, working my way through school, and fortunately veterinarians use morphine. So I had a real ability to find safe drugs and not have to run on the streets. I'm too much of a coward to be a real junkie. So I'm a cowardly junkie. At any rate, I walked into this restaurant early one morning. I'd had a few drinks. The night before had been very rough, very difficult, and I sat down in the only seat available in that restaurant. Now imagine a large restaurant filled with tables, a counter, and there was one seat available at that counter. That seat, I recognize today, was my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. You never know when you're going to sit in it. You never know when the person next to you is going to throw out a hook that's going to end up in your lip. And what happened actually is that I decided to hustle him. He was a good-looking, clear-eyed, fearless young man, and he looked like he was a soft, easy touch. He was open. He was vulnerable, as we are, for the most part. Especially the longer you stay sober, the more vulnerable you become, hopefully. And that's why life is such an experience. At any rate, I tried to hustle him to see what was going on, and I ended up that evening in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new tonight, and if you sat down next to a stranger in a restaurant to hustle him for a drink and ended up here, your drinking days may be over, or nearly over. I had a difficult time my first year and a half in sobriety. I didn't quite understand that this program worked best without any drugs. I understood that alcohol was probably... It seemed to me that you all were having so much fun, you had to have some kind of drug situation going on in the back room. You laughed in a way that I hadn't laughed for a long time. Of course, I've been hanging out in bars, and people in bars don't laugh the way we laugh. People in bars laugh from the neck up. And now that I've been sober for a while, I don't know how they do it. You know, have you ever tried now to laugh on that phony, it doesn't, it seems so real then. But I have always had a very difficult time knowing the difference between fantasy and reality. It's among my many challenges, and I just get reality figured out long enough to discover that in fact it was a fantasy, and then I start over again. At any rate, my first year and a half, I used drugs periodically. I worked for the veterinarian for a little while, and he provided me with cough syrup whenever I had a cough, which I could manufacture at a moment's notice. I had, for many years sober even, I had a prescription blank that I carried with me, and on it was IV Valium on demand. So I could walk into any emergency room anywhere in the United States and get shot up with Valium. I did that occasionally my first year sober. I found reality and sobriety. I thought the steps were easy, but the rest of it was hard. I thought meetings were easy. I hear people say, you know, go to meetings, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm here to tell you that you can go to 90 meetings in 90 days and drink and use the whole time. Sobriety is not in meetings. Sobriety is not in your sponsor. Sobriety is not in the steps. Sobriety is in you. Sobriety is in me. And I made a mistake for a long time of thinking if I sat in meetings long enough, I'd end up sober. But I continued to use periodically. I finally had to learn that sobriety was a property of Cindy Alibrandi. It was not a property of meetings. When I'm in a meeting, when I'm here tonight, I don't have to work the steps. That's like taking ice cubes to Eskimos. Right? I work the steps outside these meetings. That's where I really work the program. It's been easy for me over the years to work the steps when my life is going well. The challenge comes when my life falls apart. And you see, my first 4 years of sobriety, I didn't know life fell apart when you were sober. I noticed that it happened to other people, but I thought they were probably not working the program. That's that sort of judgmental characteristic that I have struggled with a lot over the years. And I would, you know, say the things I had heard said, what step are you working? I mean, talk about a brutal, punishing, abusive statement to say to somebody who's hurting, what step are you working? That means to me today that you don't want to hear their pain. You don't want to hear their struggle. The first 4 years of my sobriety were lovely. I fell in love. I'm actually here as a result of the men in Alcoholics Anonymous who got me sober and the women who helped me stay sober. I have a great weakness for alcohol and drugs and a greater weakness for men. And sobriety does not cure the latter. As a matter of fact, it will help you discover more about it in a whole new way. But God, as I understand God today, that source of energy that fills us all as much as we allow it to fill us, knew that I would respond to a handsome man in a restaurant, that I would respond to the man he took me to, who 13-stepped me and then took me to a meeting. For those of you who are new, the 13th step is where you lie in bed and talk about the other 12. And I personally am... I am personally very grateful for the 13th step. Without it, I wouldn't be here. Most people who talk to you will talk to you about the power and strength of the 12 steps. I agree that they are powerful and strong, but I wouldn't have even noticed them without the 13th. So, as I understand the energy, the universal energy that I call God, that energy doesn't judge how we use it. It simply provides the energy to be used. And it provided that energy to me through tall, handsome men. Because that's the kind of energy I understood. And they brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they hung out with me the first year and a half until I could find the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that happened as I began to rediscover the woman in me. And you see, I don't think there's any wrong reason to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Some people say you have to come for yourself. In my experience, that's not true. In my experience, the only reason you have to come to Alcoholics Anonymous is to sit here long enough or come back often enough until the magic happens. That's all that's necessary. There isn't any good or bad way to get here. There's getting here and coming back with or without a drink. Sometimes we say that thing at the end of the song, without a drink. That defies everything I know in 15 years of working very hard in this program. You come back with or without a drink. I came back after drinking many times, and I'm very grateful that the doors were open, the arms were open, the people were open, and all they said was, "Welcome home." That's what this fellowship is all about. Home for people like me that have a hard time learning. Home for people like me that struggle a lot, that fight with life and say it should be different and so should I. People like us stay here, stay open, and attract what's left of newcomers, of people who wander through our doors. So I met a man after I'd been sober about 90 days, another man. He was the main speaker at a conference in upstate New York. And I decided that I liked main speakers a lot, especially that one, and that I would take him home with me to Kansas City. And I did. And we had a wonderful time together. We came to Laguna Beach where he had gotten sober. We got married. When we met, I had 90 days. When we got married a year later, I had 90 days. I lived with three members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Laguna Beach, California. I went to meetings every week with Chuck C. I spoke on a regular basis with all of the powerful gurus in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I slipped down to the basement to shoot Valium fairly regularly. As far as I'm concerned, if that's as important for you to do as it was for me to do, God bless you. I would never say to you, don't do it the way I've done it. I would say to you with all of my heart, do it exactly the way I've done it if it fits you. And if that means slipping for a year and a half, relapsing, whatever you want to call it, for me it was not relapsing, it was abject terror at letting go of drugs and alcohol. Abject poverty of any way to deal with life other than drugs and alcohol. I could hear you talking about other ways to deal with life, but I didn't believe I could do it. So it took that long. During that year and a half, I was sober much more than I was using. And gradually, the sober time outweighed the using time. And you see, I have no trouble today with that as an honorable, respectful, dignified way to achieve sobriety. I happen to believe it's as valuable as the people who come in and never pick up another drink. I have learned the hard way about judging others, a very hard way. It seems to me that there's a very simple system that is probably one of the laws of the universe. When I say about someone, how can she do that in a judgmental way? Very soon, the universal energy says to me, well, honey, we're going to find out. And I then have an opportunity to walk through that same experience that I was judging. With judgment, I bring to me exactly what I'm judging, always. I can guarantee it, almost. If you keep judging someone or something harshly enough and long enough, you'll get to have it. It'll be yours. That's been my experience over and over and over. When I was 4.5 years sober, and I had finished my PhD at University of California, Irvine, I spent, by the way, 18 years in college. I told you I was a slow learner. And as a result of my marriage to Tom and my, well, at the time, I believed that because of Tom, I was sober. I had completed my PhD. I had maintained 4.5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that point in time, I sincerely believed that it was because of my marriage to Tom, that he gave me the strength, that he gave me the courage to deal with life in a way I never had before, to become functional, to complete a goal that I had worked toward for many, many years. My PhD today, by the way, I call our society's highest award for rigid thinking. I have spent the 11 years since I got my PhD trying to undo the damage that I did. If any of you struggled with intellectualizing, you can imagine that I have a degree for it. And that's what psychologists call a defense mechanism. So I have an award for defense mechanism. At any rate, Tom came to me after 4.5 years of marriage. He had written and published 4 books. I had completed this degree. And he said, Cindy, I'm having trouble in our relationship. I'm moving down the street. To make a fairly long story shorter, I was sitting in my living room with my sponsor about a month later, psychologizing. I had this new degree. I thought I may as well use it, trying to figure out what was going on with this man. At that time, I guess we were both about 37 or 30. I don't know. How old were we, Al? We were just children. Back in the dark ages when we were young and pretty. And the tears began rolling down my sponsor's face. Now, that's another thing to watch for. Those of you who are new, if you begin talking with your sponsor and your sponsor bursts into tears, hold on to your chair very tightly. My sponsor looked at me and said, Cindy, don't you know everyone else knows and Tommy is in love with another woman? I'm fond today of telling the people that I work with never to worry about obtaining humility. It will come to you. All you have to do, really, to get humble is breathe in and out and not drink one day at a time. And life will present to you opportunities to discover both your greatest strengths and your greatest weaknesses. I promptly fell apart. I wept for weeks. I went just like that. Perfect. That's exactly what I said. When she said that, I said that. I thought at the time, with 4.5 years of sobriety, that I would walk through such an experience with dignity and grace. And, of course, if you redefine dignity and grace to include weeping daily and screaming at fate, then, in fact, I did walk through it with dignity and grace. I discovered at that time that sniveling works, that if you whine and snivel and cry long enough, you will walk through almost any experience to the other side. I went to Chuck at that point, and I said, Chuck, for 4.5 years I have been such a good girl. I haven't had a drink. I haven't had a drug. I haven't fooled around with another man. I have been monogamous and committed for the first time in my life. and it's all fallen apart. He laughed in his strange way, and he said, "So, you've been in this thing for a deal, huh?" And that's exactly what I've been in it for. Tom did for me the greatest thing that has yet been done in my path in sobriety. He helped me discover that my sobriety, my strength, my courage were in me, not in him. Because the first 2 weeks, I sincerely believed that when he left, he took all those things with him. A dependency disorder is not just limited for me to drugs and alcohol. I have dependency disorders in almost everything. I thought a PhD was going to make me smart. I thought a man was going to make me happy. I thought a drug was going to make life livable. I have come to discover that livability, happiness, intelligence are inside trying to get out, not outside trying to get in. I lived my life upside down for a long time, and I reached outside of me for everything. All of my life, up to and including today, has been characterized periodically by struggle. I struggle a lot. I did that drinking, I do that sober. That seems to define my life. If I'm not struggling with something, well, how would I know? I don't know what would happen. That period of my life was a great struggle. I got a phone call shortly after Tom left. Tommy had sent my resume to the University of Arizona because he'd always wanted to live in Tucson, Arizona. And long before I graduated, he had sent my resume there. They had written back saying they had no open positions, and I'd forgotten all about it. A few days after he left, the phone rang, and it was a man from the University of Arizona saying a position had opened. Was I interested? I flew there for the interview. They hired me, and I went to the desert so that one day I was a happily married student living on the beach in Southern California. And the next day, I was a single professor living in the desert. And to this day, I have no idea what happened. It's almost as if once in a while, it seems my life is none of my business. Chuck used to say to me, "Cindy, your only job is to report for duty. Show up every morning, ask for a little guidance and direction, and then believe that you have it." I made a mistake for a long time when I asked for guidance and direction. I wondered then where it was. I used to ask about the difference between God's will and my will. That is among the more arrogant questions that one can ask, as if somehow my will could violate, break, or go against the will of a presence that is omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. I still suffer from that arrogance once in a while, but not as much. Since Chuck pointed out to me that if I would pray for the knowledge of God's will for me and then act as if, in fact, I had it the rest of the day, my life would be very smooth. It has, in fact, helped the rough places be smoother even, knowing that when I pray, I don't pray to change God's mind. That's an insane notion. I pray to change my mind. I pray to open up to life as it comes and to not struggle quite so much, to make a little progress every day in accepting life on life's terms and adjusting my attitude, not the attitude of all of you. My life has become much simpler since I quit trying to change your mind and began to work with mine. So I joined the staff at the University of Arizona, the faculty. I taught there for 6 years. I had a wonderful time. I enjoyed it very much. I have one child, a son who is now 24 years old. And when I, in 1970, 2 years before I got sober, I lost custody of my son. I was excused from the state of Kansas. I just got a new T-shirt, by the way, from a friend. It says, it's got a university emblem on it, and it says, "State of Confusion." so far my favorite t-shirt. At any rate, shortly after I got my job at the university, my son came to live with me. Now, I had prayed for then 5 years of sobriety that we be allowed to spend time together, live together, be together. We had talked on the telephone every weekend for 7 years. I'm here tonight to tell you that if you have lost your children or child, or if you have lost the right to see them, hold yourself in readiness. One of these days, they're going to get off a plane or a train or a bus, and they're going to say, "Hi there," and your life is going to change. He moved in with me when he was 14. He was 6 foot tall. He wore a size 13 shoe, and he ate $300 worth of groceries every week. And he was totally devoted to the use of drugs and alcohol. That began about a 4-year challenge for both of us. I thought surely by 5 years of sobriety I had dealt with my deep-seated anger, with my feelings of insecurity, inadequacy, etc., etc. There is nothing like a teenager to teach you that you have not yet plumbed the depths of your anger, your insecurity, your inadequacy. We had a difficult journey for quite a while. My only prayer used to be a very selfish one. God, please let him survive his lessons. I don't know if I could stand it if he didn't. I used to wish I could lock him in a closet and let him out when he was 21 and had 2 kids and a job in a bank. But that universal energy, God as I understand God, knows that we can't lock each other up. We can't prevent each other's pain. And finally one day a dear friend said to me, "Cindy, do you love your son enough to let him hurt himself?" That's how much God loves us. We're living proof that God loves us enough to let us hurt ourselves. That God will allow us to do whatever is right for us. And I finally managed to let go of my son, and within a very short time he joined the Army. The last thing I ever would have thought of. Today he lives up in Van Nuys. He works at the Van Nuys Airport. He's doing quite well. He drinks. He uses drugs. And we have come to an agreement. We never, ever talk about it. I'm very comfortable with that today. He knows where to come if he ever wants what we have. Nobody could have sold it to me 1 minute before I was ready. But on the day I was ready, in January of 1972, everything came together. And some higher power walked with me into that restaurant and said, "Honey, you've had enough. That will happen for my son. I believe that in the depths of my heart." A few other experiences that I've had in sobriety that have taught me endless kinds of lessons.
In 1979, my brother, who was 8 years younger than I, took his life. It was a tragic loss for all of us. My brother chose to shut up the voices in his head. He suffered from both alcoholism and manic depression. He refused AA and he refused lithium. And he died of his diseases. Life is, after all, a terminal illness. And his just ended at a very early age. My favorite alcoholic has always been my father. He began drinking pathologically, more pathologically than usual after my brother's death. He began ranting and raving about the necessity of joining my brother, of taking his own life. And I did what you all had taught me to do over the years. I was 6 years sober by at that point. I picked up the phone and called Alcoholics Anonymous and said, my father needs your help. And the woman at central office said, "Can he ask for it?" And I said, "He can't even talk." And she said, "We'll send somebody out." A man called on my father. He picked us up that night and took us to an AA meeting. And my dad never took another drink. Within 6 months, he was answering the phones at Central Office. He loved Alcoholics Anonymous. Dad was a salesman. And he loved people, and he was very charismatic, and he was very handsome. In fact, that first meeting that we went to, when we walked in, everybody there thought he was an old-timer and I was the newcomer. Dad worked with a lot of people throughout his sobriety. Two years ago in January, I began to feel very strange. Very strange. I began to feel omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. I began to feel that I was a unique and essential expression of higher power. I began to know all, see all, believe that I was infused with very special energy, properties, etc., etc. That feeling grew and grew and grew until February. The day after Valentine's Day, I had a psychotic break, and my father had a massive heart attack on the same day. I entered Capistrano by the Sea, a mental hospital. Dad entered a hospital in Florida. He never left that hospital. Just before he died, we had a remarkable conversation on the telephone. He said, "Cindy, you know, I'm working with 6 young men in Alcoholics Anonymous. All of them are between the ages of 22 and 35. My brother was 30 when he took his life. Dad said, "I don't know if I can ever express the gratitude I feel that not only did Alcoholics Anonymous give me back my life, but it has given me the opportunity to do what I was never able to do for my own son. And today, I have 6 sons to work with. There isn't anything else in the world that offers that to people like us, to people who are so lost and so forlorn and so alone." So Dad died making up for a lot of things he regretted, making amends in ways he never expected to make them. I have never known how or when I was going to have an opportunity to make an amend. They have been presented to me in some remarkable ways. Ways of paying back money that I stole. Ways of working with junkies to, in my mind, make amends for all the people who became addicted in my living room. There are unique and individual ways that each of us have to make amends. It isn't a simple one-to-one, "I did this to you, now I do that to him." There are so many diverse ways. My father was a great blessing in my life. I believe today, I know today, that I will miss him and long for him for the rest of my life. My mother said to me a couple of months ago, she said, "Cindy, I wonder if I'll ever get over losing Dad." And I said, "Mother, what could it be like to get over that? What does that mean? Does that mean it'll be like you never loved him? Like you never lost him? Of course you're not going to get over it. I'm not going to get over it. I'm not going to get over the experience with Tom. I know today that my heart breaks so it can open. And it has had to open over and over and over in 15 years of sobriety. It keeps closing and breaking and closing and breaking. All I have today is a little more courage because I know that each time it breaks, it means I'm a little more open to life. I'm a little less set in what I expect from life, what I demand from life. I'm a little more open to opportunities to give. That's what sobriety has brought to me, opportunities to give. But it took 5 years of taking. before I had anything to give. That's why this works so beautifully, why it's set up for people like us who are so empty when we come and who take 5 to 10 years of taking. And then all of a sudden the tables turn. Nobody knows when, because it's unique for each of us. The tables turn and the pouring out begins over and over and over. My psychotic break was a shocking experience. I had 13 years of sobriety. 18 years ago, 20 years ago now, I had a similar manic episode. At that point, I ended up in a mental hospital in Kansas City, Missouri. I had shock treatments. I was strapped to the bed for 5 days. And for 13 years of sobriety, I was absolutely convinced that that was because I drank and used drugs. As I see it today, I drank and used drugs to keep that from happening. That's why I can say that in many ways, drugs and alcohol were a blessing for me. A profound blessing. And a profound curse. So I came to you, and in about 13 years, my disordered brain chemistry took over again. My manic depression kicked in again. As a result of that hospitalization and that experience, I began taking a substance called lithium. When I talk about that from the podium, which I do sometimes, I think people sometimes hear Librium. There's a great difference between Librium and lithium, and I hope you'll find out what that difference is. It could benefit you greatly. What I would like to say about it is, it's very related to the judging I was talking about earlier. The first 10 years of my sobriety, I judged very harshly people who took any substance and called themselves sober. I now have the opportunity to be one of those people. Lithium is a salt. I take it every day. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no doubt of that. And if you have doubt about that, that's fine. Keep judging, and you'll get to have the experience. It's quite remarkable. Going insane has a lot to be said for it, especially sober. You will see the world differently from that point on. I'd just like to say to those of you who might have to take some kind of drug to deal with a disordered brain chemistry or a disordered body chemistry, sobriety is very sweet. It's very special. You have sobriety, in my opinion. Treat it with love and kindness. I'd like to close with my favorite story about a disciple whose master died. And after a few months, the master appeared to his disciple. And the disciple was thrilled. He said, "Master, how wonderful to see you. Where are you?" The master said, "Well, I'm in heaven." The disciple said, "How did you get to heaven?" The master said, "Well, you know, it took me the longest time to find out how I got to heaven. I finally went to God and I said, 'God, please tell me how I got to heaven. Was it because I prayed to you every day?'" God said, "No, that's not how you got to heaven." The disciple said, "Was it because I led so many of your children into your path?" God said, "No, nope, that's not how you got to heaven." Master said, "Well, was it because I lived my life totally by your laws and your love?" God said, "Nope." The master said, "Please tell me how I got to heaven." God said, "Well, many years ago, you were rushing home through a storm. It was sleeting, hailing, freezing cold. It was very late. You were anxious to get home, but up ahead you saw cowering in a doorway a tiny kitten.
You took 1 minute to bend down and pick up that kitten and put it inside your warm coat and take it home. That one act secured your place in heaven. So you see, we never know when we've done what we actually came here to do. It might already be done. But what I know for sure is that you all are like that man who took a second to pick up that kitten 15 years ago. So your place in heaven is secure. Thanks for having me.